Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we have a long weekend ahead of us, so it's a good opportunity for you to check out some films, whether at home or at the theater, if you're bold enough. Either way, I understand. But we'll get to a couple of films that opened this week that I talked about, and of course the grab a pencil portion of the program. But it is Usual Suspects month, apparently. I had Simon on the show last week, Simon Majumdar, always a pleasure. And we had a couple obits that happened in the film world this past week. And one, I had to bring a special guest in, again, a guest who's so regular, and so regular, he has his own intro.
It's called Inception.
Well, if you know that piece of audio, you know Brian Hartz is in studio. How are you, friend?
I am. I'm doing okay. Doing okay. We got to stop meeting like this, though. We only talk when people die.
Wow. I know. And for some, that's the basis of a show like this. But before we get to Vangelis, we got to talk about Ray Liotta. And I will ask you, sir, do you recall your first cinematic encounter with Ray Liotta?
It was probably Goodfellas.
Okay. Yeah, that's not a bad place to start.
Not really, no.
For a lot of people. But I was going back when we found out he died on Thursday, because of the success of Goodfellas and other things since then, obviously he, his bread and butter is playing tough guys or making fun of his tough guy image. And, kudos to him on that. But we should never, ever forget, I was going through his IMDb and, a little bit of television in the 80s. I forgot. And if you look this up, friends, there was a short-lived television series of Casablanca.
Oh, was that the one with Scatman Crothers?
With Scatman Crothers as Sam,
wow, yeah.
David Soul as Rick.
Wow.
Hector Elizondo not being Claude Rains, and I believe if you look in the credits, you will see a young Ray Liotta in a fez as Sasha. So look that up on YouTube.
It was a different time.
It was a much different time. but here's four films in a row from Ray Liotta, because the art house crowd had discovered him in 1986 with Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, where he is the ex-girlfriend of Melanie Griffith and the foil for Jeff Daniels, and really made an impression. Then he played Eugene in the film Dominic and Eugene with Tom Hulce. Hulce is the brother with the mental challenges and a very, very patient and loving brother from him. Then Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams, and then Henry Hill in Goodfellas. So not a bad start.
He got a pretty good ramp up there.
Pretty good ramp. And then by the 90s, you know, stuff like Article 99, Unlawful Entry, No Escape, Karina, and he did Karina, followed by Operation Dumbo Drop for you 90s Disney fans out there.
That's a, wow.
But so let's not forget the other non-tough guy roles. And he occasionally was allowed to do comedy like Karina. So,
and he was a funny guy.
Funny how?
Hey, there you are.
and he had not one, but two Muppet credits to his resume. Muppets from Space and Muppets Most Wanted. So there's some great actors that didn't get the two shots.
If you're in with the Muppets, then you're doing something right.
That's pretty good. Yeah, Heartbreakers, I forgot, is another comedy he got to do. And the man always delivered, even if his performance is better than the film itself. Never forget, his brains are eaten in Hannibal.
That's him. That's right.
Right?
Man. Man.
It, you know, I, of course, I'm probably this weekend, I'm probably going to check out Narc, which I haven't seen in quite a while. But yeah, so, you know, a big salute to Ray Liotta. Thank you. And, you know, you're in a film like Goodfellas. Your work is going to be seen forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, not to mention Field of Dreams. I mean,
that is pretty good, too. Yeah. So, yeah,
probably on the shelf of every dad in the United States.
The dad section of the video store,
yeah, exactly.
Also known as our shelves. Yeah,
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, shifting gears a little bit to Vangelis, who we found out passed away last week. And not as I was going through the info about him, I had forgotten he was in a rock band in the 60s, as was most musicians at that time,
yeah.
Before going into kind of the progressive psychedelic,
yeah.
From progressive psychedelic rock to progressive psychedelic ambient music. Can you give us a little bit of a background on Vangelis?
Yeah,
sir?
I mean, he was one of the pioneers of electronic music back in the original age of Moog with the Moog synthesizers, Wendy Carlos, Jean-Michel Jarre,
mm-hmm.
and others. And it was a time when electronic music was really as much about how good a technician you were as a musician.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen, I'm sure you have, like the original analog synthesizers.
Yep.
A phrase that seems weird. I mean, you think of synth music, you think of, you know, people playing on chintzy Casios that have the pre-recorded beats. No, these things had all kinds of knobs and dials.
And
you had
as
to
large
to
as the original computers.
Oh, my God, yes. They took up whole rooms. And so, you know, he was one of the people to along with Wendy Carlos to experiment and see like what the capabilities of these things were.
And I think he was also in the early stages before electronic music became kind of a punchline. And I'll cite an example. I remember a break on Mystery Science Theater 3000 where they're doing an 80s movie and it's the, like you said, it's the cheap synth score.
Oh, yeah.
And we get to the Satellite of Love and there's Joel and the bots and there's like three keyboards on top of each other on one end, three keyboards on the other end. And Joel is explaining to the bots how this works. So he says to Crow, put your finger on this and hold that note. Uh-huh. Okay, good. Now put your other finger over here on this keyboard and put on that note. Yeah. Now hold it for 45 minutes and you'll get signed by Wyndham Hill.
There you go.
And then Tom Servo comes in and does an impression of a certain show you hear on these airwaves, Hearts of Space. So
I used to listen to that show a lot.
It's still on, and I used to work the shift that show was on. And anyway, we'll move on because we enjoy our programming here at WFYI. We now move into the 1980s, and I believe first thing you think of when you think of Vangelis, well, at least in popular culture, of course, you're gonna hear this. Not quite the same as Bo Derek running in slow motion with an acoustic version of Bolero, but yeah, that's Chariots of Fire. I remember that when this film came out, first off, it won Best Picture, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But it had been parodied so much. There was a Chariots of Fire moment on Sesame Street.
I remember that. In fact, was my first exposure to Chariots of Fire because I was three years old. I wasn't exactly watching historical dramas in 1981.
Wait a minute. That was the same year as Raiders of the Lost Ark. I know you knew John Williams' work by then.
True, but I didn't go see that in the movie theater either. I first encountered that one on VHS. But yes, Chariots of Fur, it was called.
Wow. Very good. Very good.
But yeah, I mean, that's one of those things, though. I mean, he achieved something that, like, few others I could name have achieved, in that he's created a piece of music that just totally transcends, and you instantly recognize it, even if you've never seen the movie, never heard of the movie.
Right.
It's been used in so many, like, sports broadcasts and everything.
Yeah.
You hear that music, like, oh, people are running. It's a sporting thing.
I'm hoping he had good lawyers and agents, that the royalty checks kind of came in for that.
Boy, I sure hope so.
And okay. this was also at a time in the early 80s, a little music history, where electronic music was starting to become more mainstream. I love Mrs. Soucy. She rolls her eyes and refers to it as the fame music, because of the kid in Fame who, you know, he's going to the Arts Academy and he's lugging all the, you know, 2 tons of equipment when the classical teacher just kind of poo-poos him. And so it started to become a part of you. You were mentioning a couple of electronic composers of the era as well.
Just right around the same era. You know, there was, you know, Giorgio Moroder, Tangerine Dream did the scores for, you know, a few, actually, you know, weirdly associated with Tom Cruise in the early 80s with Risky Business and Legend.
Right. And then Moroder, I did Flashdance and American Gigolo and Heavy Metal. By the way, while we mentioned those, the podcast You Must Remember This is dealing with erotic 80s, and some of those titles we've already mentioned, Flashdance, American Gigolo, Risky Business or a Party. Go check it out.
And, of course, we'd be remiss not to note John Carpenter.
Yeah,
as
who's
well.
still making music.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, you know, he's the guy who, you know, I mean, Vangelis comes from a classical tradition, prog rock, very sophisticated stuff. You know, Carpenter, you know, like, taught himself
basically,
and still managed to I would
put it this way: I think if Vangelis is selling out an arena, John Carpenter, even at his most biggest films, is still playing at a place like the Melody Inn.
Very likely, just down and dirty. With one synth.
Right, exactly. but the other thing with Chariots of Fire was, and this becomes kind of a point with some film fans, of the mixture of period and music from two different worlds.
Yeah.
This is before Baz Luhrmann. This is before A Knight's Tale. Of, you know, we have a film set in the early part of the 20th century. Of course, the famous Running on the Beach, and it's to that. And people either really dug it or really hated it.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, they didn't have the same problem when Marvin Hamlisch did ragtime music for The Sting, which takes place in the 30s, but oh well.
I quote Stephen Stolen from the other program here, Stolen Moments. According to his mother, everything was written by Lawrence Welk. So that's take that. So, but no, Chariots of Fire won the best score that year, of course, Best Picture as well, is kind of one of the great upsets in Academy Award history. Because you are up against On Golden Pond, which is a sentimental favorite, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the fan favorite.
Oh, by far.
If they did, I guess if they did a fan favorite Oscar in 1981, Raiders would probably get it. Reds, your big Warren Beatty epic,
yes.
And my personal choice because I'm a bag. Atlantic City. I love crime dramas. Anyway, so. There is that. But here is, of course, it won, and this is Vangelis' only Oscar for the score, 1981. Here was what it was up against. Alex North for Dragon Slayer.
Which is a great score, and one of Alex North's final ones, I think.
Very good. Dave Grusin for On Golden Pond.
Huh.
Very sentimental,
yeah,
touching.
Yeah, there you
That's one. You can hum that one. Randy Newman for Ragtime.
Speaking of ragtime music.
Yep. And, of course, Randy Newman was like the Susan Lucci. He was like 0 for 20 before he finally got his just dues. And your guy, our guy, John Williams for Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, yeah.
So,
the most nominated man in Academy Awards history.
I believe so.
He's only taken home 5 or 6.
So, yeah. So that's tough. Is your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, if this is your first full film score out of the gate and get an Oscar for it, where do you go from there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there's look at that setup there. There was one that I thought of. It's another example of, and this is a, it's a period piece, but it was a decade prior. But I remember seeing this film in the theater with my dad. But it's the Costa Gavras's drama Missing, with Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek in a unidentified South American country, where her SpaceX's husband, a journalist, has been detained. Jack Lemmon, the conservative business father-in-law, comes down to try to, you know, help things out, and it's not quite that easy. And along the way, we get a Vangelis score like this. So that's the opening theme from the film Missing, with music by Vangelis. This is an example we mentioned before with Chariots of Fire, of a period piece with music of the day. And it's probably a little easier to swallow this time around, because it's only a decade prior. It's supposed to be based on the 1973 actions in Chile. Could be a lot of places. But I think also the fact that the music is from another world, and for a lot of us, ugly Americans, South American countries under political turmoil is another world. And in that case, I think it fits.
Yeah, yeah. You know, listening to the piano work on that, I mean, he specialized in those sort of haunting piano melodies. It reminds me of my first entry point to Vangelis, which was actually the TV show Cosmos.
That's right.
Might have been the world's first broad introduction to him, because Carl Sagan used a bunch of his music in Cosmos in 1980, which was a year prior to Chariots of Fire. One of my earliest memories is actually watching Cosmos on TV with my father. So Vangelis has been rattling around in my subconscious ever since.
And that's why you're here, and we love you.
Absolutely.
So same year, that's 1982. And here's, if you griped about the period piece not matching, here's this for me. This is the perfect example of the music fits the era. Here's Vangelis with the love theme from Blade Runner. Little film noir saxophone. This is the music of Harrison Ford getting dragged into a recording studio.
Yeah. I can't believe you're making me do this.
You know, well, Harrison Ford has a great reputation of being a chop buster. I can use that term. And so I think the kind of one-upmanship of, oh, if you want me to narrate this, I'm going to do it badly, and Warner Brothers just said, we're going to use it.
They used it anyway. Welcome to the complicated history of Blade Runner, folks.
Yep.
If we had three more hours, we could talk about it.
And three more films.
But you might as well just watch the three-hour documentary that's on the Blade Runner Blu-ray set.
There you go.
I mean, I think Blade Runner is probably the perfect marriage of musician and material.
Exactly.
I mean, it's so deeply embedded in the world of the fictional 2019 Los Angeles, and the whole like saxophone. I found myself thinking, we were just talking about Body Heat, which is around the same era.
Yeah,
another very noirish saxophone heavy score. I think that was John Barry, right?
Yes, it was.
But this, you know, with the electronics, just said instantly to the 80s, you know, here's the future. But had the roots in the noir
exactly.
with the sax. idea.
Love that. And yeah, I got to see the original Blade Runner in the theater in 1982, and then a decade later, I was taking a film genre class at the Ball State University. Shout out to Dr. Wes Gehring. And myself and three classmates went down to the Art House Theater that used to be on the north side for the first director's cut.
And there's at least five distinct cuts.
And are they on the last
they
Blu-ray collection?
They are all on the deluxe
Blu-ray. Okay, because I think I have the DVD collection prior, which has three.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, because let's see. There's the original theatrical cut.
With the voiceover.
There's the work print.
Oh, gosh.
The European cut, the 91 director's cut, and the final cut. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's. But you know what's consistent throughout that? The score.
Absolutely. I mean, they wouldn't. Even Ridley Scott would not tinker with that. Even Ridley Scott.
And of course, this was a film when it was released in 1982. Really got lost in the shuffle. Even though you had a big star like Harrison Ford, there was other sci-fi fantasy going on that year.
82 was like the banner year for genre film. You had The Thing, you had E.T., you had Tron. I think that was the American release.
Poltergeist.
The Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Poltergeist. I'm missing like three or four significant ones too.
So I go to we go back to Best Original Score, 1982. You know, doesn't get nominated, and it's tough. But your other nominees, Marvin Hamlisch for Sophie's Choice, and that's
A shoo-in at that time.
Not a date film, by the way. Jerry Goldsmith for Poltergeist,
which is a terrific score.
Yep. Jack Nitzsche, An Officer and a Gentleman.
Don't recall anything remarkable about that
except
one.
Except for, the song. But yeah. So maybe that's the spot he should have had. And then I get it on this one. Ravi Shankar and George Fenton for Gandhi.
Oh, yeah.
I like Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, I mean, so I love Ravi Shankar.
And of course, winning that year, John Williams, E.T.
Nobody could stop E.T.
Nobody could. Sorry, that's a juggernaut. Except Gandhi. But
in retrospect.
But yeah, nobody's watching Gandhi 60 times a year.
No.
So, but I get it. So anyway, yeah, that's 1982. And then a couple years later, and I remember when Vangelis passed away, somebody used this as one of their favorites. From 1984, the main title to The Bounty. Directed by Roger Donaldson, Mel Gibson, and Anthony Hopkins doing the story of Mutiny on the Bounty, but with this score. From the 1984 film version, The Bounty, that has Mel Gibson as Fletcher Christian, Anthony Hopkins as Captain Bly. Oh, my gosh. Young Daniel Day-Lewis is in this.
Yeah.
I think it was funny. We were talking off air. Edward Fox thought he had the and credit, and then Lord Laurence Olivier said, "Hold my beer.
Right.
I'm sitting in on this." It's produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who apparently his Bounty, everybody cries. Nobody cries when... Nobody cries when Marlon Brando's Bounty dies, which I thought was kind of a bull because the Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando and Charles Laughton was...
No, the original was Charles Laughton and
Clark Gable.
And Clark Gable.
Okay, sorry. No, yeah. Trevor Howard?
Trevor Howard.
So that was such a problematic and expensive mistake. Yeah. So the fact that Dino wanted to go into the 80s and make a version of that is pretty bold. That's one I need to revisit.
Well, it was De Laurentiis, so he probably found some ways to not make it super expensive.
Probably.
Definitely worth visiting. It's a terrific version. Early career appearances by some others, including Liam Neeson and Bernard Hill, who later went on to... you know, be in some notable art house films like Oh, Titanic and Lord of the Rings.
But listening to that music is another one of this building of you know, dread to a certain degree, because you know the title of the film, you know, the moment in the film doesn't happen right away.
Oh,
so,
certainly not.
You know, and so like a mutiny on a ship, it just builds and builds.
And, you know, that's one of the cool things about the electronic music that Vangelis did. I think it's one of the things that kind of sets him apart. You know, as opposed to trying to use electronic music to imitate, you know, traditional orchestral music, or go in totally the other direction, like John Carpenter or Giorgio Moroder, and go in like the very poppy, you know, synth pulse, you know, kind of thing.
Harold Faltermeyer.
Yeah, but he kind of lets the electronic atmosphere be its own thing. He creates something that you can't quite achieve with either approach, and that's why I think it probably has aged better or seems a little bit more timeless than something like, you know, a Moroder, you know, which is very, very, you know, 70s disco influence,
right,
and that sort of thing.
Well, we move up to my college years. Reteams with Ridley Scott.
Oh yeah.
For 1492, Conquest of Paradise with everyone's favorite explorer Gerard Depardieu. Way to go, buddy!
So. Frenchman playing an Italian in Spain.
This was also the more expensive and superior film about Christopher Columbus. I remember reviewing Christopher Columbus: The Discovery, which was, I believe, produced by the Salklands, and just garbage, absolute garbage.
Yeah.
You have Marlon Brando taking up all the space as Takamata, and you can't talk him out of anything. Thank you, Mel.
What is it with the Salkinds and Marlon Brando?
Oh my gosh! They love giving him money. So, so there's that, and Rachel Ward, Tom Selleck as
yeah. Because when you think Spanish explorers, naturally you think Tom Selleck.
Because they asked him to.
Then again, so. I suppose it makes as much sense as Gerard Depardieu.
So you're right. Here's a little bit of the main theme from 1492, Conquest of Paradise. Another example, seeing it on the big screen, much more fun experience than renting it at home.
And you know what? I 10 years ago when I had a film music blog for a hot minute, I actually wrote about this score, and it was my opinion at the time that it really hadn't aged as well as some of Vangelis's other early 80s scores, but I've re-listened to it again in the wake of his passing and kind of reevaluated that. And quite frankly, I think now that I'm thinking about the movie, the score has aged a lot better than the movie itself.
It looks great. And I always remember, I think it was on the video box, but in the video campaign, that used in all caps, visually stunning, which is a euphemism for boring as hell. And it looks great. But I think what we heard in that main theme, it fits. It fits a little easier than, say, the other period pieces we just heard because of the action, the big action of conquering the new world.
Which, you know, that, again, that's probably more of the reason why that film hasn't aged especially well.
Right, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we all go through this, and we are men of a certain age for you young folks, you will go through this, of loving something, then dismissing it, completely, and then enough age will settle in where you're like, let's give it, and then you fully embrace it.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the natural effect of that. So I'm glad you got to revisit that at this time.
Yeah, it's a terrific score. I mean, it's got an epic scope to it that you don't often hear from Vangelis's other stuff.
And speaking of epic scopes, this is his last major film credit, and here it is, the main theme from Oliver Stone's Alexander. So in a span of 20 plus years, we go from electronic music being a revelation or a controversy to just being accepted. And Oliver Stone's Alexander, which, by the way, has more cuts than Blade Runner. you know, the one and there's a lot to dissect about Alexander. We don't have the time for that. But I think, again, one of the things we don't have to break down and say what's wrong with it is Vangelis' score.
Right. Which is interesting because, you know, it this one feels like it's almost come full circle because he was a pioneer in introducing electronic music. But this was one of those movies made in the wake of Gladiator where, you know, one of the people influenced by Vangelis, Hans Zimmer, had set the template for like the next 10 years of historical epics. And so everybody was copying the exotic instruments and the floaty voice. And this is like a reaction against that. This is like Vangelis doing a classic, you know, sword and sandal Hollywood score.
Exactly. So, and I have to mention your guy, Hans Zimmer.
My man, Hans.
That's a great observation on that. So yeah, there you go. And that's it. I mean, he didn't do a lot of film scores, but obviously enough to make an impact. And we were able to bang out some info here on the film sociology.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, you know, one thing he got into, you know, on the side, like he became almost like the musician of space. You know, some of his early albums dealt with space stuff. And then there was Cosmos. And then he like literally wrote albums about space probes. Like NASA contracted him to do this kind of stuff.
So. Now, that's not a bad gig.
No, not at all.
They're slightly better than music A&R folks.
Industry. and you know, it's good stuff. Good stuff. He kept producing until like even last year.
So salute to Vangelis, man. It's that's not a bad legacy to leave in the span of several decades.
Not at all.
So while I got you here, and I'm thankful that you're here, Brian Hartz is hanging out with me on this week's program. Before we get to that, what have you been watching recently? It doesn't have to do with music scores, but you know, you have the smarter two-thirds at home and work, so what have you been able to sit down and enjoy?
Well, we've been revisiting Stranger Things in the anticipation of the drop of season 4, which we are probably going to be getting to a little later today. You know, speaking of, you know, electronic music, you know, score heavily influenced by John Carpenter and others there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, finally, I mean, this is how far behind we are. We finally got caught up with The Greatest Showman, which was like 2017, I think.
How did BB like that?
Well, she adored it.
It was funny because I remember you posted that. Man, people have strong feelings about
that show. They sure do. I'm not one of those people who dismisses musicals. I love musicals. This one didn't do it for me. Like as I said online, it feels like a committee of greeting card writers tried to do a Baz Luhrmann movie and just didn't do it right.
But Beatrice liked it.
Oh yeah, she
is. Is this one thing that she's going to watch every day for months?
I hope not.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
We're taking a car trip soon, and she's asked to listen to the music while we're in the car. So,
boy.
Yeah. Oh well.
Okay, fingers crossed.
She's had worse fixations. I mean.
We all have had.
Yes.
So it's all right. So I've been going through a little bit of inside baseball. So my smarter two-thirds were out of town this week. And what normally happens when a film dad is by himself is this is the time that you break out the darkest, warpest nonsense that you can watch without being judged by your family. And I've done that. Not as dark as you think, friends, but I revisited Boogie Nights because I keep, that's my daughter's 20. I'm like, you really need to see this film, but probably not with us.
Yeah.
Probably not.
I mean, there's a family of sorts in the movie.
It is a family film. It just so happens that it's in the 70s porn industry. So there's that. And then I revisited Life Force. Now, he's laughing. So, and by the way, check out Golan Globus's take on Life Force. It's Toby Hooper with vampires in space, basically.
Which, and I think it was literally based on a novel called Vampires from Space.
I believe so. They didn't want it to have such a chintzy title, so they made it Life Force.
Yes, they just let the rest of it be chintzy.
Man, and it's one of the more expensive canon films. It was shot in London, and I need to post this on social media, but in one shot, so your star is Steve Railsback, so... Yeah, they save some money there. But in one scene, you have Charles Manson, Jean-Luc Picard in one of his early roles. He has a little bit of hair. Our favorite kid from Equus, and little Alex's probation officer. Yes, all in one scene.
Yep.
Those guys. So you're like, oh my gosh, that's a that guy character actor's dream.
Yeah, yeah, very early for America appearance for Patrick Stewart and tried to do some questionable makeup work.
Yes, and there's a space vampire lady,
Matilda May.
I think that's all those who know the name and know the film know exactly what we're talking about, and we're just going to leave it at that.
Something that could probably only have been pulled off in a low-budget movie in the early
80s. She was a dancer and was willing, and that's what happened. So that's the guys run Hollywood, and we're terrible, and the British film industry. All right, anyway, so as if all of that wasn't enough, I'm sitting through the credits, and I see what I did not expect to get blindsided by, music by Henry Mancini.
I guess he was just after some royalties at that point. I don't know.
Well, and I know there is another cut, not nearly as many as Blade Runner or Alexander, but there was another director's cut, and Michael Kamen brought some stuff in, which, sure, it's Michael Kamen. That's another topic for another time. If you want an action movie score, you get Michael Kamen from the 90s. But I was looking through, what was Henry Mancini doing at the time? Of course, Henry Mancini, when you think of filmmakers, he's most associated with...
Well, 60s, but specifically Pink Panther.
Blake Edwards, right.
Blake
Edwards,
yeah.
So I was going through, and I'm like, what was he doing at that time? So I'm going through just... Oh, my God. Just the 1980s. We're going to change of seasons. No. Backroads. No. SOB. That's Blake Edwards. That's fine. Condor Man. Action Disney.
That was a thing.
Mommy Dearest. Victor Victoria. That's Blake Edwards.
More Blake.
As was Trial of the Pink Panther. Second Thoughts. Never saw it. Curse of the Pink Panther. Okay, you can stop exploiting Peter Sellers now. Harry and Son. Life Force, Santa Claus the movie.
Oh yeah,
paid him. They paid him that one. The Great Mouse Detective.
That was a terrific movie.
Yep. A Fine Mess. That's Life. Both Blake Edwards. Blind Date. Blake Edwards. Glass Menagerie, directed by Paul Newman. Not Blake Edwards. Sunset. Blake Edwards. Without a Clue. Michael Caine and Ben Kingsley as Holmes and Watson.
That's one that has not crossed my radar.
And Ben Kingsley, of course, it's the theory that Watson did all the heavy lifting and was the smart one of the group.
Right.
Welcome Home, Physical Evidence. Ooh, God. Ghost Dad. Moving on. Married to It, Son of the Pink Panther was his final credit. Final feature credit.
And
wow.
Was that the one that was...
Ted Wass.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not Roberto Benigni. No,
okay, all right.
So, yeah, that just kind of throws me. I'm like, I didn't know he did that many scores, but I guess, guys got to work, so.
Oh, well, sure, yeah. The funny thing is the score for Life Force, though, it may not be the most well-remembered of it. If you're a film score geek, it shows up in a lot of compilations of, sci-fi movie themes.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, he gets the check. Hopefully gets the check, so
right. There's
that. But yeah, so anyway, that just kind of blindsided me. I'm like, well, who would dig this? Well, Brian would dig this. So
and indeed I do.
All right. Well, Brian, I appreciate you coming on and breaking down Vangelis and some other odd stuff. And hopefully you get to watch something enjoyable very soon.
Summer movie season is upon us. And, of course, we've got summer streaming TV
coming
as well.
Or you get Harold Faltermeyer and Lady Gaga collaborating because, that film came out.
All right.
Thanks, Brian.
That's all I have to say about that.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil, I want to tell you about a couple of films I got to watch recently that are new streaming, new in theaters. Over at the Can-Can in Indy, they still have this for one more week, but the drama called Emergency from director Kerry Williams, set on a college campus right before spring break, two classmates of color are about ready to do a party crawl. I don't know what those were when I was in college. And they're also at the same time arguing with each other. One's more responsible than the other about turning in their projects so they can go to grad school. And as they're preparing for the evening of going from party to party, they come to their dorm, or I say their off-campus apartment, I should say, which the door is ajar, and there is a face-down, passed-out young white girl. And what their roommate is listening to headphones, playing video games in another room, doesn't hear any of this coming. So what we have is the kind of fish-out-of-water situation, and not only how do you handle it, but also the moral implications with it. The responsible one wants to call the police. The other one, who has a record, does not. He's also been smoking weed. So what happens when two black men call about a passed-out white woman in their house? So it's more complex than the morality tale of what is right and what is wrong. And so they finally start to decide to take her to the party area on campus and leave her there. Easier said than done. It doesn't go wacky. There's a few dark comedic moments just based on college student choices. And then the girl passed out in question. Her sister is also trying to find her, and there's an app which can make a link to her phone. So we have this very kind of slow pursuit, not slow pace, but a pursuit of eventually the two parties meeting. I will say this without giving away too much. It could have gone down a much darker path and doesn't. There are still a few moments. There's a great moment of that it kind of hits at home of the two African-American students and their roommate, Carlos, of Mexican heritage. And they are trying to get the girl out to the woods so she can use the bathroom. And then the suburban couple, the white suburban couple with the camera filming them, accusing them of being drug dealers. And as the group finally gets in the van and drives off, the nosy couple with the camera phone have a Black Lives Matter sign. It could have been the message could have been hit a lot harder. Unfortunately, it does not. I will say when it comes to the climax, it almost appears like it's going to be wrapped up in a pretty little package. Not so pretty. So just a couple subtle moments near the end. As I said, it doesn't go as dark as one would expect. There's a climax near the end, or I say right before the end of the climax, that feels like the film Ambulance, and it doesn't go there. So anyway, I wound up liking it a little better than I thought, and it's more than just the wacky college kids or wacky, what choices need to be made. But Emergency from Amazon Studios, it's available streaming, and you can check it out over at the Can-Can. From IFC Midnight, we have a Romanian drama called Watcher. We have Julia, who's an American, who has moved to Bucharest with her Romanian boyfriend. So he's with a new company. And early on, we get the feeling of being an outsider and being by yourself. A lot of her isolated in the apartment, learning the language, going from store to cafe. And she winds up seeing a gentleman across in the building across from her watching her. So this, I think the mixture of isolation and this, also there's a subplot about a serial killer that's been roaming through the cities. So all of this starts to get into her head. And eventually there is this is the type of film I would mention. For those who've never seen films about voyeurism, you're probably going to like this more than I did. It does go down a certain path, and as I remember in my notes, going the other way would have been a little more interesting. It's the, is he or isn't he a killer? Or is this not all in her head? Even at 90 minutes, it could use a little tightening, especially in the second half of the film when we get to the scenes we've seen before. Nobody believes her. Is trying to plead to somebody, anybody, to check out this gentleman who's been looking across the way from her. Watch Rear Window instead. So IFC Midnight's film, Watcher. So there you go. Okay, before we grab a pencil, let's see what's going on. I mentioned the Can-Can. They have starting June 3rd, and you'll be hearing about this hopefully on next week's show, as well as the Blues House Party, where you can hear music from the documentary Jazz Fest, a New Orleans story. So very excited about that, about the history of the Jazz and Heritage Festival down in New Orleans. Happening is still going on at the Can-Can. Do not miss that. Men is also playing there, the latest from Alex Garland. I mentioned Emergency and, of course, Everything Everywhere All at Once. Coming soon, Best in Show is part of the Outdoor Series on June 1st, Crimes of the Future on June 2nd, as well as on June 2nd, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So a golden opportunity to see that on the big screen again. And the 28th, Black in America, the Heritage Series with All Deliberate Speed. My Neighbor Totoro on June 4th, Citizen Ash on June 4th and 5th, and Clueless, presented with Pattern on June 5th. All of that is happening over at the Can-Can. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin this weekend, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Friday and Saturday, depending on when you're listening to the show. Clue, again, don't know which ending they have. That's part of the fun, I guess. June 3rd and 4th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Big Trouble in Little China. And listen to Golden Globus Theater's take on Big Trouble in Little China. You really should. Hi, guys. They gave me a nice shout-out on this week's program where they discuss Predator 2. They've not done Predator. Predator 2, it's their show, and they'll riff on whatever they want. June 7th, 10 a.m. Tuesday, Scooby-Doo. Sure. June 10th and 11th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Sandlot. And all of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In, Screen 1, Top Gun Maverick, Days of Thunder, if you want to see that on a big screen again. Screen 2, Men and the remake of Firestarter. Screen 3, Bob's Burgers and Doctor Strange. Man. And Screen 4, The Bad Guys and Sonic the Hedgehog 2. All that is happening at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, Top Gun Maverick plus The Lost City. That is happening this weekend. And June 6th, Monday, June 6th at 6 p.m., Back to the Drive-In documentary celebrating National Drive-In Day. And then, of course, mark your calendars, Friday, August 26th for the Super Monster Movie Fest. Size matters. All of that is happening at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. And oh, if you're a Vangelis soundtrack completist, yes, Brian and I did not talk about Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon or Francesco, the film with Mickey Rourke as St. Francis of Assisi with Helena Bonham Carter. Sorry. All right, grab a pencil, friends. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. So we start on Twitter. Hot scrolling here at Film Sociology, of course. Josie Alma Press, publisher of The Worst, anyway, writes, Ray Donovan, the movie, Human Lanterns, and Hot Dog, the movie. Don't do the Hecuba interview piece. You know the monologue there. And if we talk about teen flicks, I will keep you in mind. Thank you there. oh, my gosh. Yeah, there was some nonsense on Twitter this week. I will tell you that. J.P. Roscoe writes, a rewatch of City of God, which is still one of the best films of the 2000s, and Titane, which is something for the people who like Cronenberg and Tsukamoto. My daughter dug it more than I did, and that happens sometimes. So, yeah, there you go. Going back to Facebook from last week's post, because that's how Facebook works, Aaron writes, Men, or as another reviewer said, well, that was a movie, all right. Linda writes, Made in Italy, the film with Liam Neeson. Lucy writes, Downton Abbey, New Era, it was great. Eric writes, Top Gun, never saw the whole thing before, have no desire to see it again. David writes, Blade Runner 2049, The Batman, and Tombstone. Adam writes, Doctor Strange. Tony writes, Minari. Alan writes, Knives Out. Daniel writes, Dear Evan Hansen, The Music Man. But which one, though? Death Trap, An Ideal Husband, and Dial M for Murder. Joe writes, The Quick and the Dead, and Toscano. Jamie writes, Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. Try not to speed that one up, friends. Downton Abbey, A New Era. Spider-Man, Far From Home. The live-action Beauty of the Beast, and Encanto. Magnus writes Hulk and The Lighthouse. Melissa writes The Lost City, Senior Year, Top Gun Maverick, The New Firestarter, and 2008 The Incredible Hulk. Sam writes, Sam Watermeyer, Jackass 3.5, A House on the Bayou, Jackass 4.5, and Monster. Nikki writes Downton Abbey, A New Era, and The Greatest Showman. Erica writes Catch-22, The Big House, Take the Money and Run, Doctor in the House, Ski Troop Attack, Robot versus the Aztec Mummy, I hope that's Mystery Science Theater, and Land of the Pharaohs. Thank you, Chief. Joe writes A Few Dollars More and Respect. Emily writes Treasure Planet. Nikki writes Three Christs, excellent cast, really good but sad. Stephanie writes Watching The Offer, recommend in all caps. Amanda writes Memphis Belle and A Letter to Three Wives. Doug writes Imitation of Life, The Gang's All Here, Female Trouble, and two more Hitchcock films, The Ring and The Trouble with Harry. John writes Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Catherine writes Revenge of the Sith and Josie and the Pussycats. I know you, Catherine. That was a double feature. I know that. Andy writes The Batman and just responded with several Z's in a row. Dustin writes Sense and Sensibility, the 1995 version. Megan writes The Proposal. Corey writes Seven Stages to Achieve Eternal Bliss. David writes The Mule. Nancy writes The Lost City, cheesy and predictable and super fun. Megan also writes The Lost City. I hear it's Sandy B's last movie for a long time, for a long while, and it was a good send-off. She is good at what she does. Well, hopefully she'll get back to the movies. I call her Sandra Bullock. I don't know her well enough to call her Sandy B. Gretchen writes Doctor Strange. Phil writes Operation Mincemeat. Said it was good. He had never heard that story. Rachel writes so many because quarantine. My favorites are starred. Oh, okay. Barb and Star visit go to Vista Del Mar. Senior Year, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Monster-in-Law, Office Space, Peggy Sue Got Married, Date Night, and The House Bunny, which she says is a fave because of Emma Stone. Okay. Brenda writes Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Lila writes Doctor Strange. Scott writes The Marksman and They Call Me Trinity. Eric writes First Time Viewing Roberto Rossellini's Germany Year Zero and A Week of Rewatches with My Closest Movie Buddy, Sense and Sensibility, Ordinary People, Quiz Show, All About Eve, Sunset Boulevard, My Fair Lady. Strong, very strong there. Andy writes Zoolander. Lou Harry writes The Valet, Ultranonencia, man, I'm sorry, London stage production of Anything Goes, which he dubbed disappointing. Jenny writes Top Gun. Allison writes Maverick, you know. Allison writes Bob Lazier, Area 51 and Flying Saucers, Superhuman, The Invisible Made Visible. And then writes, I'm at my mom's. She always has weird documentaries to show me. Emma says that about our house. That's all right. Only me, not Lynn. Nick Rogers writes, After Yang, Our Father, Men, The Fast Runner, Top Gun Maverick, and Black Sight. Tom writes, Vampires from Bikini Beach, and then says in parentheses, Don't ask. To which Eric replies, No need to. That is self-explanatory. No, Tom, answer it. Tell us why you watch Vampires from Bikini Beach. And tell them about my shows. Okay, back to the list. Oh, Jeff, my buddy Jeff Caperton. He's also one of the panelists on Drinks with Dee Dee, and you should really listen to Drinks with Dee Dee this week. It's a lovely tribute to Ray Liotta. Jeff writes, The wife and I rushed to the theater to see Downton Abbey, and when I finish with this film tomorrow, I'm going to Nashville where I will see Top Gun. Thank you, Jeff, for the update. He's an actor, you know. Cassie writes, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and America's Scariest Monsters. Kurt, also in Drinks with Dee Dee, the new Downton Abbey film, Star Trek The Motion Picture, a Fathom event, The Northman, all in the cinema. Very good, Kurt. I wish I had seen The Northman on the big screen. Shakespeare and Love and Cabaret at the Beltrace Movie Nights. A lot of movies this week. Very good, Kurt. Let me know how Cabaret goes at Beltrace. Wow. Jeff writes Constantine. Abby writes The Covenant. Jay writes, We saw Family Camp last week. Cute. We're seeing Top Gun Maverick tonight. Yes, you are in the danger zone. Sure. With Archer. Rachel writes, Under the Moon and Dr. Fives Rise Again. Neither were as good as the original, but not horrendous. And Vincent Price is just plain fun no matter what he's in. Very good. Taylor writes, Dune, the original one re-edited by a fan. It was really good. Oh, jeez. Operation Mincemeat was excellent, and I saw the Batman again. Cassandra writes, Jurassic World, Top Gun, and City Slickers 2. Anthony writes, about to go see the new Bob's Burgers movie. Robert Muggy writes, The Sea Wolf, The Cobweb, Peter Ibbotson, Soul Power, and seven classic jazz shorts, apparently newly remastered, featuring Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway, Bing Crosby, Hoagie Carmichael, and Billie Holiday. Thank you, Robert. Sean writes, Rewatch Casino, Planning the Sea Maverick. Molly writes, Doctor Strange, Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, and The Kingsman, Golden Circle. Aaron writes, Doctor Strange. Kurt writes, I watched two on my flights, The Trailer Park Boys, the movie, were you in Canada, and my favorite Sandra Bullock, The Net from 1995. That's your favorite Sandra Bullock movie? Granted, there's a great scene of Sandra Bullock in a bikini on the beach with a laptop, and she thinks she's a dork, because that's what Sandra Bullock did in the 90s. You know, it's like my favorite employee of the rail system in Chicago, Sandra Bullock in While You Were Sleeping. David writes Blues Brothers and Blade Runner 2049. Ron writes Once. I love Once. So more people should see Once, the film and the musical. James writes Gun Crazy, film noir of the 50s, but the title seems to describe our country today. And look up Taffy DeVee's take on Gun Crazy. Worth checking out. Gary writes, Shaun of the Dead, Helltown, Abandoned Mine, Little Dead Rotting Hood, The Shortcut, American Mary, Men, and Return of the Jedi. Somebody asked him what he thought of Men. A lot to digest in this film. It reminded me of The Green Knight, which was also a film that had many ways in which you could interpret the action. There were a total of 8 people who saw it with me, and I think we had 8 different interpretations of what happened in the film. Overall, I dug it. Very cool. Very good. Janet writes, Mirror, Mirror, August Osage County, which I revisited last week and listened to the commentary track. The original Inherit the Wind, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Carlito's Way, Cruising, which I also revisited for the first time in years, Ira Red, Bull Durham, and Steel Magnolias. Carrie writes, Big Hero 6, again. Alan writes, Being the Ricardos and Downton Abbey. Nick writes Barbara Rubin and the Exploding New York Underground. Nick writes George Carlin's American Dream. That's on HBO Max. Joni writes Hairspray, the musical. Cute, but I like the original better. And Broadway Danny Rose. Then I tried Hair, but didn't like it, although the costumes were fantastic. I'm bummed, Joni. I love the film version of Hair. I just do. Kathleen writes Tully. William writes Red Riding Hood and The Gentleman. Jeff writes, well, now I have to watch Goodfellas. That happens when an artist dies. I get that. I've done that. Sean writes Red Rock West. Frank writes, I hesitate to admit this, but you write it on my Facebook page, Frank. But I recently rewatched the film Ice Pirates. Don't do this. However, go to Golden Globus Theater, and they have a takedown of Ice Pirates. So that's fun. There you go. I know, man. Robert Urich, Angelica Houston. What can you say? Judy writes The Adam Project. Bob writes Top Gun Maverick. Bob Bloom. Spencer writes, It's a show instead of a film, but it's about the making of The Godfather. I'm so impressed with the offer on Paramount Plus. John writes Operation Mincemeat. Well done. Based on actual events of World War II. Michelle writes Death on the Nile, doesn't say which one. Thomas Crown Affair, doesn't say which one. Valkyrie, Logan, and Escape from Alcatraz. And never forget, that was one of the early Fred Ward films, was one of the inmates in Escape from Alcatraz. Joan writes West Side Story and Downton Abbey. And finally, Linda writes Gucci. Don't know if it's House of Gucci, it's Gucci. So there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching. So hopefully you've been able to watch some films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Oh, by the way, Top Gun Maverick opened. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Have a great weekend, everyone. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you've let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!